Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. And if you were listening to today's interview and would like to be featured on the network, please visit speakuptalkradio.com for all of the details or contact us at PR@speakuptalkradio.com. And right now, I have the pleasure to share an award-winning author with you. He is Dennis Kohler. Dennis has published 3 novels and is currently hard at work on his 4th. His protagonist, Tom McGuire, is a former POW in Vietnam and now a world-weary, somewhat cynical San Francisco Police Department homicide inspector. Dennis was born and raised in San Francisco, and he earned his degree in philosophy from St. Mary's College of California. Upon graduating, he entertained the idea of opening a little corner philosophy store in San Francisco, but soon came to the realization that sometime in the past 600 or 700 years, the market for philosophers had cratered. Therefore, he taught high school for 6 years, earned an MBA, and transitioned to a career in collegiate administration. He began writing his first novel, The Oath, in 2008. 4 years later, he knew if the novel was going to be finished in his lifetime, he'd have to work on it full-time. Therefore, in early 2013, he made the leap, exchanging the everyday working world for the everyday writing world. And he got such a rush when The Oath was finished in early 2014, he immediately began writing another novel, and then another, and he is now working on his 4th. And Dennis says, since he started writing books, his bank account has become decidedly smaller, but his satisfaction meter is off the charts. I live in a delightful community with a wonderful, loving wife, and my reputation for well-written, page-turning mystery thriller novels is growing. I'm loving life. Well, you can't beat that. So let's find out how we accomplish this. Welcome to the network, Dennis.
Pat, I appreciate your having me. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. And you know, I really love the idea of a little corner philosophy store. Wouldn't that be just so cool?
Yeah. Reminded me of my growing up in San Francisco, you bet.
My, I don't know. It might work today, do you think?
Yeah, it might work today, yeah. You'd have to sell cannabis, though, along with the philosophy.
We'd get a lot of philosophical ideas then, wouldn't we? Oh, my gosh. Right. It's something to think about if you're ever getting bored.
You bet.
So what was it like early on when you said goodbye to making a traditional living and decided to become a first-time author?
Well, you know, it was delightful. Yeah, at the time, I live in San Francisco Bay Area, so I'm about 25 miles from the city. That commute to San Francisco was, you know, it was taking an hour to an hour and a half each way every day, and you know, everybody can say I can spend my life a lot better than sitting in a car getting mad at other motorists. So we just decided to, you know, I had started The Oath about 4 years before. I had finished about half of it in 4 years, and I learned a lot about writing in that time. You know, I mean, I had a story I wanted to tell, but my goodness, you need characters, and it's my first book, right? So you need characters, and you need dialogue that actually makes sense, and, you know, you need a protagonist, and so on and so forth, and I said, I got to do something about this, and there's no way I'm going to finish this unless I do it full time. So mm-hmm. I left and finished the book actually in 2014. I published it as an ebook, and that was going to be the end of my writing career, but it wasn't because it gave me the bug to continue this. It's a great profession. You know, it's not easy, but it's really fun.
Well, you have to be congratulated for taking that leap. I just know there's so many people that have dreams in their mind and in their heart, and a lot of times you settle for the what's given and think, well, maybe someday, and often someday doesn't arrive. So
is true, too. I've known a lot of people like that, and I didn't want to be one.
Mm-hmm. No, I appreciate that and applaud that, really. I do. So your first book was titled The Oath. Give us a synopsis.
Don't mind, let me just tell you the reason I even wanted to write the book in the first place. Is that okay?
Yeah, that was my next question, so we'll do it this way.
Yeah. So I had a story. I've always been kind of, throughout my life, I've been interested in things strategic, military history being one of them, you know. And it's not necessarily the, you know, why we got in a war or did war, I mean, whoever was in war, but what, why they did things in particular battles that you know, what they saw. Why did they make decisions X, Y, and Z? And, you know, so I went through this. I went through in my lifetime, I went through a whole Civil War period of my life, and then I got into Vietnam. And one of the things I read early on was a history book, actually, on the POWs that were mostly pilots shot down over North Vietnam and held in real, you know, horrible suffering they went through. And I'm thinking to myself, these guys are really American heroes, you know, to go through all this for their country, and no one knows anything about them, you know. And so this was back in the 90s, I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking, oh, maybe I'll write a book about this. And so I that was started the genesis of it. But then John McCain comes along, and he's starting to tell the story. So anyway, so I gave it up for a while. But in 2008, I said, you know, I am going to tell the story in a way, in a fictional way. So I thought about the oath itself, the oath that all military people take, you know, that I do solemnly swear that, you know, I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, you know, dot, 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 so help me God. And I started thinking about, well, you know, foreign enemies, that's a no-brainer. You know, everybody knows what a foreign enemy is, but what would be a domestic enemy? What would somebody who's taking that oath think it was worth fighting for against a domestic enemy? And that kind of started the story, the actual fictional part of it. So I take the life of two kind of young naval aviators that took the oath. Both were shot down over North Vietnam, and together they endured, you know, 6 or 7 years of really brutal torture, which they all did, by the way, just historically true, at the infamous Hanoi Hilton. Well, now it's 4 decades later, and one is a San Francisco homicide inspector, Tom McGuire, and the other is a guy who was married, had no children, his wife has died, and he now has cancer, and he decides, you know, it's payback time for all those sufferings that he went through. And his, you know, he begins selectively killing Americans in the anti-war movement who went over to North Vietnam during the war. And so now there's a tension between two people who have this same common experience, who both took the oath, and one just reads it differently. And one is sworn, the inspector, Tom McGuire, is sworn to not, you know, I mean, he took the oath to put murderers in jail. So that's the tension of the story, and that's how it kind of came about.
So there was social commentary that you wanted to express within this story.
Yeah, mm-hmm. There's, you know, what I tried to do was to take both of those views and give them a fair hearing. You know, that kind of comes from my philosophy background. So what is it that drives both protagonists, both characters in the story? Mm-hmm. One, you know, and with both the shared experience. So that was, I think, the kicker here, that they both endured those tortures, and they both encountered Americans who came over there during the war, and actually some of them were actually the cause. I mean, this is, again, historical fact, that were actually the cause of some of that suffering and led to the death of a few of those prisoners. So to seek revenge, you know, is not a good thing, mm-hmm. but one can understand that. And so what I tried to do is to be sympathetic to both of those issues and try to play them out against one another. So at the very end of the story, you know, there's a climactic scene, and they both sit there and give their kind of philosophical view of the war and America's place in that war. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a social commentary there. But I think it's an even social commentary.
There you go. As you're speaking, I'm thinking screenplay.
yeah. Well, you know, I would love to have that happen. But that's, of course, for a different discussion.
No, I understand. I understand. It just hit me when you said that. But The Oath has received excellent reviews, as well as the winner of the 2016 Bay Area's Independent Publishers Association Award for Best Fiction. So how exciting was that?
Well, it was right out of the blue, and so very, very exciting. Yeah, and it's the kind of thing that keeps us indie writers writing. You know, that you're recognized in some forum that, you know, that you don't control, and you don't pay off people to say nice things about you.
Mm-hmm. So, no, I get it.
Yeah, so it was really for me. Listen, my chest was puffed out for a week afterwards.
Good for you. It prompts you to keep going.
It does. It does prompt you to keep going.
Yeah, I can understand. So your character, Tom McGuire, he shows up in all of your books, right?
He does. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kept that going. You know, I've never been a policeman, and I've never been in the military. So it's just that I've come across these people in my life. And I grew up in San Francisco and went to high school, and, you know, a lot of my classmates became police officers, and so I would just sit around over coffee and donuts talking to them about what goes on in the force and you know, their life and really how all of them face stress in their lives so much. I mean, I really give a lot of credence to, you know, police officers. They have a tough life, and they only see the seedy side of life, you know, which is really not pleasant, I think.
No, not at
all. Anyway,
I
learned that that's the kind of the cynicalness of life comes about. Feel that when you talk to people in the police profession, and I don't blame them, you know.
No, you couldn't help but feel that or get that from them if that's what they witness all day long. Yep. So your second book, Kissed by the Snow, what made you write that one? Maybe give us a sneak peek.
Yeah, Kissed by the Snow is a story of America's war on drugs, and drugs have always, I taught high school for 7 years, and I saw drugs just destroy kids, destroy them, and so, you know, kids coming in as freshmen, you know, they're 13, 14 years old, and, you know, by the time they're juniors, they're just different people, and I ascribe that mostly to, you know, drugs. I'm sure there's other things going on in their lives, but it's so. I always had that kind of I don't want to say hatred for drugs, but what they do, and it turns out that America's. I had just finished The Oath, by the way, and I think I probably mentioned this before, but when I said the end, you know, I got such a rush out of saying the end to The Oath that I had already thought about this drug business and I thought, you know, what if there was? It's the war on drugs is the longest continuous war in American history. It's been going on for 60 or 70 years. In fact, some people, by the way, say that our involvement in Vietnam was mostly about drugs, about the Golden Triangle in China, South China, and opium. So, and I mean, I don't know if that's a fact or not, but I thought, you know, over the years we have lived through, you know, this war, and it never seems to be won. And so what if a group of FBI kind of, I would say rogue FBI guys got together and said, you know, we have a way to do this. And what we'll do is we'll seed, well, here's what they saw. They saw that the war on drugs as fought in this country has been on two fronts. Either it's been against the, they know it's a business, so it's a business that has supply and demand. So they fight the supply that they, you know, in Argentina, in Colombia, you know, we used to go down there in Colombia and Mexico. We're trying to, you know, get crop dusters to destroy the opium poppies. And so that's kind of does this, but it doesn't quite work, you know, and because the demand is so high, mostly in this country, that's what keeps whoever growing this stuff, getting this stuff and bringing it in this country because the demand is so high. So then there was a whole push against the demand side, which is Nancy Reagan's just say no, you know, they're saying, you know, now they're putting kids in on the street corner in jail for selling dope and so on and so forth. So but nobody has gone after both demand and supply at the same time, and that's what this novel does. And it comes up with a very unique way of solving the drug war, and they win, but they don't do it in a good way. So what I try to get the audience to see is that, you know, do the ends, just in your own life, and in general, this is, again, the philosophical view of life, do the ends ever justify the means, you know? Mm-hmm. Here they've won the war on drugs, and now you look at the inner cities, and they're more peaceful, and families are getting together, and kids are going to school, and blah, blah, blah. But a lot of bad things happened in order for that to happen. Mm-hmm. So that was the intent I had of Kissed by the Snow.
And everybody should be reading this and thinking about it, because it is such a devastating problem, not only with our youth. I do a lot of work with healthcare providers, and you know, so many of our healthcare providers are addicted as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is a scourge. There's no doubt about it.
It's a serious problem.
Yeah.
All right, so that was book number two. And now number three, The Custer Conspiracy, is a crime novel interwoven with history. So how did we get there?
Well, that's a good question. I've always been a kind of a Custerphile. And kind of what I want to do is I have this view of using fiction to describe, and I don't want to go overboard in this idea, but I do think there's something to it. Fiction can give meaning to events that we see around us through a pair of kind of fresh eyes, as it were, you know? And so you can take a concept and that you like drugs, for example, and say, what do we do with that kind of stuff? And so you, in fiction, you can get away with a lot of things that you in polite society you can't get away with, and it seeps into people's psyche in a way that they're not aware of a lot of times, which I think is a good thing in a certain way. So with Custer, I went up to the battlefield a couple years ago. My wife, you know, one of my bucket lists was always to visit that battlefield and just to see what Custer had saw when he was there. And what you find is he got rolled over, and there was nothing he could do about it. He wasn't a bad guy. He was a good general, actually, but he was both outgunned and outmanned, you know. I mean, he was just overwhelmed. That battle lasted about 30 minutes. What I thought about it was, we have a cavalry or an army who is out after the Plains Indians, and you have a battle and so on and so forth. Who benefits from something like this? Well, in this particular case, there were a lot of beneficiaries, you know. One is that the country was so, I mean, this is historically fact, the country was so so angry at Custer that he was a big hero in those years. And they were so angry that he was wiped out, essentially, that it was the populace that demanded that the military rearm themselves. And because after the Civil War, you know, the country was broke, and one of the biggest losers was the military. So they demanded the military rearm, which they did, and go after the Plains Indians, which they did. And within 5 years, you know, the Plains Indians were either dead or on reservation somewhere. And so the practical consequence of that was that the land, America, west of the Missouri, was opened up for settlement. And, you know, a lot of people made a lot of money on that. But you know, if you look at history, I was saying the arms dealers. And so this is a story about arms dealers. Custer is just used as a foil to say that, you know, if your conspiratorial mind were at work, you could, in fact, and which I try to do in this novel, is you could kind of explain the last 140 years of history by saying, you know, the arms dealers knew what they were doing. I just give you a quick example. A quick example is in 1876, July 25th of 1876, George Custer's troops were fighting with single-shot rifles. Now, they were against Indians who, about 800 of them, had repeaters. Okay, the army didn't even have repeaters, you know, lever action 15 shot magazines. They were single shot magazines. Single shot. So, shoot, open up the thing, pry out the bullet, put another one in, close. Okay. 20 years later, now that's what the Army was in 1876. 20 years later, battleships, American battleships, were lobbing 5-inch shells into the Spanish fleet in Manila Bay. 20 years, I'm thinking to myself, how did that happen? How did that happen? You know, and then 16 years after that, the world engulfs in one of the, you know, worst wars ever, you know, where 17 million people lost their lives because some punk anarchist kid of 19 years old shot an archduke in Serbia. So who wins in all that? That's what I kept. That was the whole thing. So my business with introducing Custer was to show that, you know, and then there's kind of, listen, I don't want to go into the plot because I'd like people to buy this.
Sure, we don't want a spoiler.
It's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting. I think it is. And it's gotten, you know, it's been out only a couple months and it's done fairly well. So,
you know, you said something at the beginning, which I think is a great idea. When you talk about fictionalizing a problem, because if you wrote a book about Custer, you would have, the Custer fans or a handful of people reading it. But when you put it in this kind of a format and you fictionalize it, you're going to get a much larger audience of people now appreciating what went on.
You would. And I think, and again, it gives you a vehicle through which to take a look at our modern life and say, is this, you know, and I'm not saying this is, you know, listen, arms dealers don't control the world. But, you know, there's something about that. I mean, about war itself that, and all the, you know, I mean, we've all lived through really chaotic times in the last, you know, last century, for the whole 100 years and even before that. And you know, a lot of it's just chaotic times in war. People shooting at each other all the time and everybody's angry and blah, blah, blah. So who would benefit through all that? That's all I said.
I wrote that down. I wrote that down when you said it. I wrote, who benefits from this? And I really think that is a classic question that people should be asking, not just in this scenario, but in actually every scenario. And it kind of gets you, it drills down to what's really going on if you can answer that question.
It does. Yep. I that's exactly what I think, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, this is fiction, so I don't want to, you know, this is a conspiratorial mind at work. And, you know, so
all right.
I'm saying it's true. But there is something to it. That's all.
That's why I brought it up as well. So I'm on your page. So when you write, do you have a particular audience in mind?
Here's my view. This is pulp fiction. You know, it's not War and Peace. It's not Melville. You know, it's not Shakespeare. You're not. You know, it's entertainment. So an audience that it's. I think it's decent writing. You know, I think I'm a decent writer. It's entertaining. It's a book. These are books that you would take on an overnight flight and you would finish it on that flight. They're very fast moving. They're very, you know, page turning, and you're going to forget them in 4 weeks. You know, it's like going to see The Bourne Identity. It's entertainment. That's what it is. It's like a movie. It's entertainment. And it's not, you know, it's not something, you know, it's not like going seeing Shakespearean play somewhere and raving about it for the next 4 years,
right?
Or a ballet or something like that, something that has some kind of meaning. This is just strictly entertainment. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking for that kind of audience, you know.
Okay.
And you don't always find those people, but that's a kind of what I think. Yeah.
So is that your goal, that you hope your readers gain from reading your books, is that they are entertained?
Yeah. Well, entertainment has to be the reason people read stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I hope they learn something through it.
Right.
That's what I do. Mm-hmm. And I write the book that way. So that, you know, if they're of a mind to reflect on what's being said in there, yeah, they'll learn some things. And even if they don't reflect immediately, you know, what I learned throughout my school and, you know, it's just being around is that you pick up stuff just by reading the paper, for example. You read, you know, people nowadays read headlines. And their whole view of the world is formed by headlines, you know?
That's true.
So, and a lot of them are fiction, too, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this character in humans that they absorb things without them ever really knowing it.
Interesting.
And that's what I think is both good and bad about fiction.
Very true. You talked about learning. You want them to learn something. What have you learned about yourself as you write?
Well, I'll tell you what I think I've learned is this sounds pedantic, and I don't mean it like that because I do think I really do believe this. Plato was right when he said, you know, the thing I know best is that I don't know anything. And that I think is what I've learned this is, you know, it's what do you think you know? Well, you know, what's good for it's good for yourself, what's good for the world, what's good for your family, blah, blah, blah. And finally, what you really know best is that you don't know anything. You know, I mean, there's a huge world out there, and a fraction of it that you know means, you know, you don't know any of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I've learned. I write and hope that I learn some stuff and the reader learns right along with me.
Kind of a humbling experience.
It is a humbling experience, yeah, but it's peaceful too. At the end of the day, it's really peaceful. Mm-hmm. I don't know this stuff, you know, and so don't get mad at myself or anybody around me.
I like it. I like what you're saying. Let's talk a bit about your writing process. Where, when, how does that look to you?
Well, you know, if you're an indie author, your writing process is you write a little bit and then you, let's say you finish a book, you could spend the rest of your lifetime marketing the book that you wrote, or marketing, you know, it's just, it could consume you. I tell you, it's a very strange dynamic that I think authors like myself, at least, go through, and that is that it's, you want to carve out time to write, and you get the whole thing, it's like that 4 years I spent working and then trying to write The Oath. You lose all concentration, you lose, you know, you even lose the dots that you have to know to keep the story going. So you have to write, and you have to write and have to do it in chunks of time. But at the same time, if you only do that, then you don't market your books. So nobody knows about them, so they sit on Amazon's 15 million bookshelf, and nobody knows that you're there. So it's a real trick to try to juggle those two things. So the process for me is I think about writing. I mean, I'm writing this fourth novel now, and in February this year, because Custer came out in October, the end of October, and I'm spending most all my time marketing that and et cetera. So I said, I got to do product. I mean, I have a product that I sell, and I have to have more product. So I said, I had an idea for a book, and I sat down and I started writing it. And in February, and I got through about the first, 25,000 words. So I'm about a third of the way through the novel, and I haven't touched it in a month. You know, my bad. But the world has a way of doing that. Well, I wish I could say I was like Hemingway. I started at 5 in the morning and write till 9. Well, that ain't me. So when people listen to this, don't take me as an example. You should set your time down and say, the heck with everything else. I've got to get this book finished and put together and then... After you finish it, you can then go start marketing your other books.
You know, I don't know that there is an answer. Everybody seems to struggle with the whole concept of writing and marketing and all of that done at the same time. So it's really a matter of balance and how it is that you balance things. And I know for me personally, I've given up on the idea of being stressed out when I take time away, say, from writing or what I think that I should be doing, and just figure, okay, it's brewing somewhere inside, and maybe it's just not the right time for it to be coming out right now, and I need to be doing what I'm doing. I think sometime if you could just let go and let what happens, it all hopefully seems to work out in the end.
I tell you what, I couldn't agree more, and I think you're absolutely right about that. The trick is actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I mean, that's absolutely right. I tell myself every morning, just exactly what you said, stay focused on the day.
Mm-hmm.
Do what you have to do, and it'll take care of itself.
Yep.
You know, and if you get writing done, because I, you know, when I go to bed at night, I think about the book. You know, I mean, that's what I do. I think about the story and how it's going to, you know, and I'll get up in the morning or get up even at night, and I'll write down little notes about what I thought about so I don't forget. And that's helpful because I've actually put the story together. I mean, I know exactly what my new book is going to be like. It's the first time I've ever done that. First, I know what it's going to be about. I know, you know, all the way up to about chapter 20, what it's going to be about, and I know how it ends, and et cetera. But I just have to do it.
Just have to get there. Well, you've got a good head start.
Yeah, I have a good head start. That's right. I don't feel too bad about that. Yeah.
All right, so that's your fourth book. Does it have a title yet?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right.
I'm slavishly copying Michael Connelly, so I hope who's a great he writes Harry Bosch novels, which is police
right.
LA.
Right.
Great writer. So I'm slavishly copying exactly what he does.
All right. Well, then we will just wait for this to come out. Well, we've covered quite a bit today. Is there anything that we missed, though, that you would like to talk about?
No, I think this has been cathartic for me, too. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. I really do. It's really been, as I say, cathartic. I hope it helps people who listen to this.
Actually, I think it will. It's always good to get a fresh perspective and for people to realize that they're the same as you or you're the same as they are, and we can all accomplish what it is that we want to do in life. Just got to get out there and do it. So where can folks go then to learn more about you if they'd like that, and where they can purchase your books?
Let me just give you my website. It's easy enough. It's Dennis Kohler, DennisKohler.com. And let me offer listeners, if they, I'm open. I do love to talk about this stuff and to use my experience and thought process to anybody who cares to listen to it. So they can get in touch with me through that website, and then, we can start a dialogue if they so choose. Your books are on Amazon, obviously, and they're all in ebook form also, and you can get them through any bookstores that are still open, but you'd have to ask for them. They won't stock. They don't stock them.
All righty. So we'll send folks to Dennis Kohler, and that's K-O-L-L-E-R, DennisKohler.com. Dennis, what a pleasure to meet you and share your words of wisdom and your advice with everyone today. And we will be looking forward to this fourth book.
Pat, I appreciate it again. I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to talk. It's what matters in this business. So thank you very much.